This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Each Friday on Cincinnati Edition, we present an in-depth discussion of the developments behind the headlines. This Tuesday's mayoral primary attracted a low percentage of voters, with Councilmember Yvette Simpson taking first place over incumbent Mayor John Cranley and first-time candidate Rob Richardson Jr. And the Cincinnati Bengals made a controversial hire when they drafted Joe Mixon. It's our weekly review of local news, and joining us first to discuss the outcome of Tuesday's primary, WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and managing editor, you're not a managing editor yet. That was a leftover word there. Cincinnati Business
Nice
Courier. Yeah, she likes that. Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and managing editor. No, not yet. Chris Weider, and columnist Chris Wederick. And Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter Jason Williams. So thanks, everybody, for being here this afternoon. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
And, and Amanda, you got a promotion. You didn't know that was going to happen today.
Yeah, I'm going to come more often.
You can be part of the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So we had Yvette Simpson finishing first, 45% of the vote. John Cranley was second with 35%. And then Rob Richardson Jr. had 20% of the vote, and he's now out of the race. So what was the turnout for this, Jason?
Not good.
Not good.
Better than the last time, though.
Better than the last, double the,
really?
The last time. 11%.
11%. Okay.
Yeah, 23,000 and some odd number voters total.
Out of 217 in the city.
Yeah.
Okay. And the prior primary was just under 6.
Yeah, but the prior primary, there were really only two serious candidates competing. I mean, there were four candidates running, but two serious ones between Roxanne Qualls and John Cranley. So I was a little surprised at the turnout. I mean, the numbers were trending that way. But you saw so many Democrats, right, after Donald Trump's election that, you know, were holding rallies and making Facebook posts. And I talked to a lot of Democrats that said this is a really big wake-up call for us and we're going to get more involved in local politics. And you know, primaries are different and hard to glean a lot off of, but that kind of surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of depressing.
Yeah.
Some of us paid quite a bit of attention to this race, and not many voters got too worked up about it, apparently.
If I'm not mistaken, even after, what was it, September 11th, 2001.
Mm-hmm. More people voted
more,
than that
more people
more
voted in that particular primary, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But that being said, you know, the result, I think, was surprising to a lot of people. I guess it wasn't surprising if you looked at Simpson's polling, but that the polling that she did, that she put out, that was before Mayor Cranley dumped hundreds of thousands of dollars in negative advertising at her, comparing her votes on the streetcar to, you know, her votes against or her vote singular against giving more money to the police chief. So that, you know, he attempted to do what he did to Vice Mayor Qualls 4 years ago. He attempted to define her for the voters. And, you know, it makes you wonder how effective that kind of television advertising mm-hmm. is anymore. You know, I don't know a lot of people that sit there and watch commercials unless it's the news or unless it's sports. And that's where a lot of the advertisements were. But, you know, it just didn't seem to make much of an impact on voters.
Do we know what parts of the city had the highest, what precincts had the highest turnouts and how that might have impacted the vote?
Yeah. I think Jason looked at this pretty detailed.
You look more at the precincts. I think you were tweeting about it last night. But I look more at the wards, and College Hill and Pleasant Ridge and Kennedy Heights, like way, way up. And those are very, very critical area, highly engaged. You got to give Yvette Simpson's campaign credit. The data show that those two wards have been highly engaged in the last few years in like any election. And they went in there, and there's a lot of – they did direct mail in there and ground game, and people turned out for them. And that was a big deal. And certainly those are two of the top 10. There's 25 wards, 26 wards.
26, yeah.
Yeah. And those are two of the top 10 largest wards in the city. So you also have to consider that there's a really diverse, those are racially diverse areas, and they're also economically diverse areas. So you have a very wide swath of voters, and I think you can look at those two wards, and you have to be feeling pretty good if you're the Simpson camp right now and think, yeah, let's build on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took a look at some of the precinct data over the last couple of days, and mostly what I was looking for is like, okay, well, how did the mayor do in the precincts that he did the best in 2013? And there are about nine precincts that roughly stayed the same in their boundaries. Sometimes the Board of Elections changes the boundaries for these precincts. And he actually ended up losing, I believe, three of them that he had won by 80% or more. One was in Bond Hill and one was in Roselawn. Those are heavily African-American areas of the city. So it kind of tells you one thing, that that black voters who supported the mayor very heavily in 2013 have abandoned him, or at least did in this election. And then some of the other ones, he just basically didn't do as well. So he would rack up 60% of the vote instead of 80 or 90% of the vote in some of those precincts. And I also looked at some of the swing precincts, ones where, you know, Roxanne and John finished, you know, 11 points or less apart. And I think basically in the 12 that you could compare year to year, Simpson won 10 of those 12. So some of those swing areas have swung very much towards her at this point. Now, the difference between 13 and 17 is that Cranley is going to have 6 months to try to figure this out, mm-hmm. whereas Roxanne only had about, you know, basically a month and a half, 2 months. Mm-hmm. So he's got a lot more time to figure out what went wrong and how to fix it.
And turnout was lower, too, in some of the areas that supported John Cranley as well. I mean, there was one West Side precinct that had 8 people come out and vote. I mean, there was very low turnout in the areas that were supportive of him, and you saw higher numbers in the areas that supported Yvette.
I'm amazed when you're talking about picking a position as crucial as mayor that turnout's that low.
Yeah.
Did Dwight Tillery and the supporters of the Center for Closing the Health Gap, did that affect this? Did that hurt Cranley?
You know, I was kind of curious about that as well, because Dwight has been pretty quiet, at least on social media, but they did have like the Health Gap Expo, the race, and they have been, you know, holding events, been pretty active, and those events supported Yvette. I mean, they've been pretty vocal up the Black Agenda, which Dwight is a part of, has been pretty vocal about supporting Yvette, which was also kind of interesting given that Rob Richardson Jr.'s dad is also one of the founders of the Black Agenda as well.
I have no idea. You know, when we spent some time talking to voters on primary day, we talked about, you know, myself and a stringer for the Business Courier, we talked about 30 voters. And, you know, it was interesting just to see what they brought up when we asked them, what were you thinking about when you went into the voting booth? Nobody really mentioned the Center for Closing the Health Gap. Ten or so of them mentioned the streetcar, and some of them were pro streetcar people, angry at the mayor. Some of them were anti streetcar people, angry at the mayor because the streetcar didn't get canceled, and they, you know, interestingly enough, cast their votes for Simpson. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to figure out, you know, whether this is actually a thing, like people who are mad at him because the streetcar is still going, even though he did everything he possibly could have to stop it. You know, swinging towards Simpson. And the mayor didn't really have much of an opinion when I asked him about that, about whether that was something that they noticed in their own data and their own analysis. But I'd be curious to see, you know, if there are some anti-streetcar people punishing him for, you know, basically the city council overruling him on the streetcar. And I believe the columnist for the Inquirer, Byron McCauley, at least found one of those same type of voters as well. So, you know, that's just super interesting, and I don't know quite what to make of it, whether it's a bigger deal than it is.
I do want to be clear, though. I don't think the health gap played a role necessarily in this primary race. I think that Dwight Tillery organizing things like the Black Agenda, which held events leading up to the primary, really rallied black voters and was very vocal about their support for Yvette Simpson, did play a role in how people voted.
What about Republicans being ticked off because of Cranley's stance on sanctuary cities? Did that play any kind of role in this?
Yeah, I believe it did. I you know, I've talked to a lot of people about that, and I talked to Alex Triantafilou yesterday, and the answer to that is anecdotally, yes, I think some people behind the scenes have crunched some numbers, and I believe it shows that, yeah, that it did hurt him. And I know what Cranley's polling was on that specific issue, and I can unequivocally say, yes, it did hurt him. And you look at the turnout on the west side, the traditional Republican conservative areas, certainly on the west side and in Hyde Park, Oakley, not so much Oakley as much, but Hyde Park certainly. Mount Lookout. And he did not dominate as much in those areas as he has, you know, in the past, in the primary than last time.
Simpson told me that she's, you know, some of those traditionally Cranley friendly, Republican friendly areas, you know, she told me that she's not necessarily conceding some of them, not so much the East Price Hills and the West Price Hills and certainly Mount Lookout, which is, you know, kind of the center in my mind of Coast / Tea Party movement in the city, the small movement that it is. But, you know, she says, we're working hard in Westwood. We've got a group in Hyde Park that is contesting races or contesting, you know, that will contest the election. In Westwood, that's a changing neighborhood. That's not as much, you know, predominantly white, you know, German heritage as we used to see. Westwood's changing. So, you know, I think that's a neighborhood she's put a lot of effort into as well. You know, I think the mayor's got his work cut out for him, but he's not gonna be caught flat-footed without a what we call in the business a ground game. Basically, these are the people that are calling your phone, asking you to vote, visiting your doorstep, texting you now. So he's not gonna be caught without doing that next time, I think.
Yeah, which it was non-existent this time.
Yeah, yeah, he relied mostly on TV ads, and that did not work well for him. I think a big challenge, too, he'll have is he just spent a lot of money on a race that he didn't win and spent a lot of money on TV ads. And that's going to be a challenge going forward with donors. I mean, to entrust that much money with him and then spend it all on a strategy that didn't work is going to be a problem for some donors. And on the flip side, people are now going to donate to Yvette Simpson because she's a more serious candidate now. So that's going to be an interesting battle going forward as well.
Yeah, I mean, related to that, I mean, Amanda's totally right about that. And it's the second election in a row that that's happened. Don't forget the Parks levy in 2015. Mm-hmm. A lot of corporate Cincinnati ponied up a lot of money for that. It went down in flames. And so this is kind of the second election in a row where they have not seen a return on their investment that they probably would have liked to seen. So I would guess some of them are going to be hedging their bets. You know, when we look through their campaign finance stuff, you know, the one name that stuck out to me as someone who gave to all three candidates and who's a major player in Cincinnati is Tom Williams, the president of North American Properties. He gave money to Cranley and lesser amounts to Simpson and Richardson, which is something you see in a lot of cities. Mm-hmm. In Cranley's case, they've put all their money on him, and maybe that changes now.
That happened actually in the Dieter Strehaus race this fall as well, mm-hmm. too. You saw towards the end when things were looking a little more at least dead even or favorable towards Denise, you saw some major players making some donations to Denise Strehaus just in case she won. So you probably will see that with
hedging your bets. Yeah. Yeah.
And they don't, you know, for them, it's not even really ideological. They want to make sure that they have access, that mm-hmm. they have a seat at the table. And you know, 8 years ago when they put all their money on David Pepper, they found themselves not maybe listened to as much as they wanted to by Mark Mallory. And so I wonder if that lesson is going to be learned or not.
Let's talk to Charles in Blue Ash. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Listen, I have two questions. One, is there a residual leftover with the Blackwell firing that affected the election? And the other one is there going to be something coming up in regards to this health department issue and the closing of possible health department branches? The reason I'm asking about that is that almost everybody's a mum on that, except people walking around in the community.
On Blackwell, I'm sorry, go ahead and finish.
Go ahead. No, I'm fine.
On Chief Blackwell, nobody brought that up. I was kind of curious to see when we were in Bond Hill and Avondale and trying to talk to voters whether anybody would talk about the chief. And it wasn't so much of that. It was and there's a guy we quoted in the story. I mean, he basically said, I think the mayor's kind of a jerk. And we tried to weed some of that out just to see. I mean, some of those people were Qualls voters last time, and so they were already disinclined to like him. to dislike Mayor Cranley, but I do think that there's maybe a personality issue that some people have with him, and I think that played a role because Simpson is so personable. You know, mm-hmm. she's just a kind of a likable person, and the amount of time she spent in community councils and these little house parties that they have, and I think that really paid off for her. As for the health departments, I don't get a sense. I mean, until we see the budget and some of those things actually, get on the chopping block, I'm not sure that we're going to see much of a political effect of it.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and joining us to discuss the outcome of Tuesday's Cincinnati mayoral primary, WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, and Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter Jason Williams. You can be part of our conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Chris, do you think that Yvette Simpson was surprised by the results?
On election night she was, which was interesting because she kind of went, up until election night, she always tried to project confidence that she was going to win. And I think everybody was skeptical about that, but she was always insistent that she was going to get this done. And election night, she listed about 7 or 8 things that worried her. One of them was John's money. Another was she dropped some direct mail in the days before the election. Some kind of snafu happened, and some of that direct mail probably didn't arrive until Wednesday or Thursday. So, that was a waste of money. There were various things like that. I think when Rob Richardson got into the race, that worried her because Rob immediately tried to seize the mantle of, I am the change candidate. Those two are the incumbents. I will bring change to City Hall, when she kind of viewed herself as the change candidate. So I think she was worried that was going to be, that aspect of the race was going to be taken from her. Boy, I think Rob did her a big favor by getting into this race, because if he hadn't, we wouldn't have had a primary. We would have no idea the state of the mm-hmm. race other than polling, but no actual voters casting votes. So, now everybody kind of knows the state of the race, at least as it comes out of the primary. And I think people are going to take her a lot more seriously.
Well, and I think that's the difference that you just see overall between the two candidates. Yvette took this very seriously. She knew what she was up against. She knew she was going to have to work really hard for this, whereas arguably John sat back, ran a few TV ads. I mean,
went on vacation last week.
That's what I was just going to say that. I mean, so I don't know that he was taking it,
Was he too confident about this?
He's an incumbent. Every yeah. incumbent wants to be able to, they don't want to have to go out and shake hands at the church festivals this summer. I mean, every incumbent wants to be in John Kasich's position running against Ed Fitzgerald, where they don't have to do anything. So I'm sure that's what he was kind of hoping for. And
I don't know, though.
Found out now.
I wonder what his polling told him up in, he did at least 2 polls, probably 3. I can't imagine. And I know that Rob did a poll as well, and it didn't show John doing particularly well. I think it showed him winning. But I just wonder how, I never got the sense. They were never really boastful about it. They were never really like, we got this in the bag.
They would squeak by. I mean, it was a primary, so they weren't too worried about it in general, Sargis.
When you spend $675,000 on advertising, you're worried, or you're running scared, or you are somewhat taking it seriously. But it was sort of a mixed message there. On one hand, you're spending all this money, but on the other hand, we're not seeing you outside of the City Hall cocoon much. Mm-hmm. And I think Chris, alluded to John Cranley's personality. And, leading up to this election, it's hard to gauge what the rank and file voter thinks about whether your mayor's social graces are all that great. I think this may be said a little bit, at least about that it has trickled down to the rank and file, that the rank and file sees him as, he's not, maybe he's not the warm and fuzzy guy, he's just not a warm and fuzzy guy. And so I think for him to overcome that, he's going to need to get out there and get that face-to-face thing going and knocking on doors and making phone calls to the rank-and-file voters.
I think that's also what makes this the TV ad strategy so interesting is that, one, he very much tried to play up that warm and fuzzy feeling with, you know, the couch time with the wife and talking about that. And two, I almost wonder if it backfired running all these negative ads against Yvette. I mean, that kind of plays into that notion that you're maybe not the nicest person ever when you're running attack ads. So, and it got her name arguably out there even more among voters, and people that didn't like him might have seen an alternative. So I would be interested to see how and if their TV ads and ads going forward change.
More lightsabers with his kid, I think. That's what I want to see in the
I think you'll see a lot more. Yeah, I don't know if you'll see more lightsabers or not, but that's certainly interesting. I do think you'll see a more tempered advertising campaign from Cranley. I also think you'll see a lot more pointed, this is what we've accomplished in the city, and more championing that, and, oh, this is my record versus this is her record. I might not be the nicest guy in the world, and she might be nice, but look at what I've done for you versus what she's done. I think you're going to see some of that.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And let's talk to Kathy in College Hill. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good.
And go right ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say a comment about Cranley. I did not vote for him in this election. The reason I didn't was because of the streetcar. One was that he did do everything to try and cancel the streetcar out, but it is here now and is here to stay with the tracks are laid. And so, therefore, the negativeness around this does not bode me well to vote for him as the mayor of our city.
That's something, yeah, I heard, is how can you say that you support the streetcar, but then simultaneously run an ad calling it a trolley and kind of making fun of it a bit. I mean, that's some mixed messaging there.
Yeah.
I'm going to be interested to see how this affects business at City Hall. I mean, just going through the place on Wednesday, you know, there was kind of two different attitudes. There was, you know, the pro-Cranley people were kind of walking around in shock. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the anti-Cranley people, it was like, you know, to continue with the Star Wars analogy, it was like the Return of the Jedi. The Ewoks were like celebrating and, you know, singing a song, you know, but we're not quite there yet for them. So, you know, I think that, you know, they have a budget coming up that's due this month, and it's got to be passed by June the 30th. And I think we're going to see a ton of political jockeying over that budget and people trying to, you know, get themselves in an advantageous position, not just the two mayoral candidates, but also the members of council who now, six of them are incumbents and face re-election. So, you know, that's just going to be tremendously fascinating to see how that plays out.
I think Cranley spent, in retrospect, I think he spent way too much time pounding on the streetcar over the first. I mean, he certainly, you know, when he saw the election on the horizon, he has really toned down his rhetoric, probably in the past, really since the middle of last year, I think, somewhere around in there. But he spent, 2 years continuing to really just bash it and hammer it. And I don't know if we're seeing some of the residual effects of, or the negative effects for him on that. But certainly I think people are fatigued enough to move on. And I mean, at this point, I don't see it being a defining factor in the race.
He needs to find, a different issue to talk about, because the streetcar is up and running. It's going, it's not an exciting issue in this race. There's nothing on the line here, you know, as far as the streetcar goes. So I don't know that people are really all that interested in it now at this point.
You know, when I talked to him yesterday, the mayor left open the possibility that he would not be talking about it as much. I mean, you can still tell it's kind of a crutch. He still kind of goes to it when he wants to, talk about the differences between himself and Simpson. But I think he's got to find something else.
Yeah, and it became harder too when all of the candidates agreed that they would focus on bus service and expanding bus service over expanding the streetcar. That kind of
Here's the thing. Like, you look at 2013, you had two really clear-cut issues. Mm-hmm. Streetcar, do it or don't do it. Parking deal, do it or don't do it. And Cranley was on one side and Qualls was on the other side. The line was drawn and they just went at it. The issues in this race, it's very muddled. It hasn't really been defined yet what that defining one or two issues are going to be. I think that was what Cranley came out of this as. He tried to make it about, define it again with his ads, and it didn't work, or at least it didn't work in the short term. I don't see it really what he – I think what the $675,000 he just spent is done. Like that there's not going to be any long-term like, a voter in 3 months is going to look back and think, oh, that's right. He said this about Yvette Simpson on the streetcar, and now it's making an impact. I think that's all lost, and he's got to come up with something else now.
Jason, does John Cranley, comparing their two ground games, it seems like hers was just vastly superior, and that was one of the key things in tipping this race. Do you think he realizes he's got to get a better ground game out there at this point?
Absolutely, and he's said it, and he just doesn't. He didn't have much of a ground game in 2013. And again, I think, he was able to rely a lot on the money and a lot on two defining issues. And the fact that he was an outsider, I mean, he was not really an outsider, but he was an outsider because he wasn't currently at City Hall. And, this time he's particularly when people know that he's not such a warm and fuzzy guy, that he's just got to get out there more. In order to compete better and give himself a chance to win, I think it's going to be really close, and that's one way or the other. It's going to be really close.
Brian emailed. His question is, "What happens to the Richardson voters?" He ran as the anti-incumbent, and Brian says he thinks that is against Simpson, maybe more than Cranley. And he also wants to know: has Richardson said if he's going to run for another office in the future, or if he's done?
Richardson did not say he's going to run for another office. He cannot run for city council. That's not allowed under the charter after he ran for mayor. As for who his voters go to, I think people will be a little bit surprised by this. Just anecdotally hearing some of the background about the polling that both Simpson and Richardson had done, I think they showed more of the Richardson people going to Cranley than people might expect. I'm not saying a majority of them will go there, but, it might be a 60-40, 70-30 type of situation. So, Rob tried to run as a bridge builder. He continually noted that he served on a board of trustees at UC with every other board member was a Republican. So he tried to use that to make the case that he, could work with Republicans. So he probably did attract some of those Republican voters that, that John would normally get. Even though Rob's a huge, huge labor guy, and so that's kind of an interesting dynamic as well. And we're still waiting to see whether he'll endorse somebody. I think that's the biggest question for him going forward is whether he weighs in on the race.
And Rob actually had a more – I agree with Chris, but Rob actually had a more progressive platform than either candidate, arguably.
On some things, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think that necessarily came through. So I kind of agree. I think that more voters than most people would think will go to Cranley as well. And it will be interesting to see who he endorses because him and Cranley have a history together. I think he noted a couple of times that they used to be friends. I don't know if they still are after this race. We'll see. But it'll be interesting to see where the endorsement goes.
I think you could see Rob run for state rep in his district. He lives in Mount Auburn. I think you could see that as being potentially his next step.
So what does Yvette Simpson need to do between now and November?
I think she kind of needs to keep up what she's been doing. I mean, hopefully she will get some more money to play with. So, although this is the opposite of what we've said Cranley should do, but hopefully she has enough money to run some TV ads, get her face out there a little bit more. I think her ground game was really strong. She used social media, text messaging to get voters out. So I would say stay the course for her mostly.
Mm-hmm. Avoid getting tangled up in some serious budget politics that are coming up. I'd imagine that she's going to vote no, no matter what. So, but we'll see, you know. And then, you know, from a governing standpoint, that I think that's one thing, you know, she's going to need to figure out. And then, you know, raise money, because John's going to come at her on TV again. And, you know, he's going to try to find a better message. And she'll need to counteract that. And, you know, John Cranley was a councilman for a long time. And there's probably things in his voting record that can be exploited the way that he has exploited Simpson's record and the way he exploited Roxanne Qual's record in 4 years ago.
What about John Cranley? Jason, what does he need to do now between now and November?
Well, certainly, I think he needs to get out there and get that face-to-face thing going and get the ground game going. I think you'll see the Republicans turn back up for him. The Republican vote alone, will that save him? No. I also think you're going to see his labor support really rise up now. Mm-hmm. And labor has a tendency that the ground game is a big deal to them. And I think you'll see a very motivated labor outreach. You're going to see some West Side. There's a PAC that's going to start up on the West Side, led by Pete Whitty. And I think that's had some impact in past elections, and they do the ground game, the knocking on doors and calling people. So I think that's going to help him. But in the end, will it be enough? I don't know. I mean, you certainly, we live in a world now where, you know, people want change. And, I think you're seeing Yvette Simpson, really capitalize on that.
I think he needs to. Also, I mean, there is a difference between him and Yvette in the sense that he doesn't need to attack her on it, but the sense that he has more of a record and has accomplished more as mayor. And he needs to sell that. He needs to be reminding people, this is what the city looked like 4 years ago, and here's what I want to do over the next 4 years. I don't know that we saw a lot of that in this race beyond kind of the typical, I balance the budget and minority contracting is up, but he needs to be in neighborhoods, you know, on the riverfront, in OTR, that sort of thing. Real tangible differences that everyday voters can appreciate.
I don't know how he does this, but, you know, the great historic thing that I think he did that, you know, if he, you know, he's always going to be remembered for, you know, at least for amongst government geeks is getting that pension on the road to solvency. And, you know, I don't know how you put that in an ad, right? I mean, I fixed the pension system. The voters would be like, pensions, what is that? You know,
do people still have pensions?
So he's got to figure out a way to, you know, if he's going to put that in an ad to make it, you know, to make it really hammer home with voters.
I think go ahead. I think he needs to also let go of the fact that he thinks he's a progressive or he has all these. I think he needs to stop trying to appeal to the white, left progressive voter. He is the streetcar thing. He is never winning those folks back. So, mm-hmm. You know, the sanctuary city thing, I know he tried to do that to win over some of those folks. It didn't work. It alienated a big part of his base. He needs to get back to kind of some of the basics of not trying, I guess, to win over those folks and just forget about it, to be honest with you.
I agree.
Jason, Chris, Amanda, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Good talking with you. WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter Jason Williams. Coming up, we're going to delve into the Bengals' controversial decision to draft Oklahoma running back Joe Mixon with the Inquirer's Paul Daugherty and WCPO.com's David Holthouse. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. There's been a lot of debate about the Bengals' decision to select Oklahoma running back Joe Mixon in this year's NFL draft. Mixon was 18, just getting ready to start college, when he punched 20-year-old Amelia Molitor, breaking several bones in her face. Mixon later agreed to a plea deal on a misdemeanor assault charge, and he was suspended for the 2014 football season. In April, he reached a civil settlement with her. Cincinnati Inquirer sports columnist Paul Daugherty and WCPO.com managing opinion editor David Holthouse join us right now. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can be or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Paul and David, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Sure, glad to.
Quite welcome.
And Paul, tell us about your reaction when, you heard about this particular draft pick.
The pick itself was predictable, and my reaction was one of disgust.
Okay, and you're looking at this as just is this just more of the same for the Bengals? Do they is this just part of their history and their culture now?
Sure, yeah, they bottom feed. They're very good at finding really good players whose value has slipped because of something they've done off the field. And they did that this time again. Experts had said that Mixon was almost as good as the kid Fournette from LSU. Fournette went very high up in the first round, and is will make $27 million over the life of his 4-year rookie deal. And Joe Mixon went late in the second round, and will make $5 million over the life of his 4-year deal. So that's a $22 million savings for the Bengals for a player who most said was almost as good as the number one running back taken in the draft.
Don't the Bengals have a history of being this employer of last resort for wayward football players? I mean, doesn't this thing go all the way back to the team's founding in 1968?
Well, they did pick a guy up from a federal penitentiary and drive him to training camp. If that answers your question.
Okay. So definitely part of their history. How frustrated does this make you with the Bengals?
Anymore? Not much. I mean, I'm used to it. If you follow this team at all, you might be angry and frustrated and what have you, but you note that ultimately none of your emotional investment matters. If you're a fan of this team, they disrespect you all the time with this sort of thing. They really don't care what fans think. And I think fans over the last several years have made it pretty plain that they're tired of this sort of behavior from the players that they either draft or sign as free agents. And the Bengals are so concerned about that, they just go ahead and draft another one. So, no, I'm not. I just sort of shake my head. It doesn't really consume my days anymore the way it once did.
Now, you wrote about Amelia Molitor, and I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about her, because you make a good point.
Well, I wrote that column. We headlined it "Say Her Name" because she's like a lot of victims. She's not really a person to a lot of people. She's just some woman who got in the way of a guy's football career. You know, and we need to know who this person was that was punched in the face and had 4 bones broken. And this is who she is, and who she was a young lady who grew up outside of Dallas, loving Oklahoma football, who actually went to Oklahoma and lived in the same dorm room her mother had lived in 32 years prior. She was not a saint. She had some problems with marijuana, if you want to call them problems. She had a few other issues, none of which is relevant to her being punched in the face. I just wanted people to understand that these aren't just faceless young women who are being abused. They have names and they have lives, and their lives are disrupted, if not ruined, by the actions of abusers who, I'm just guessing, suffer a whole lot less than the people they abuse.
Paul, what do you think of some of the defenses of Joe Mixon that have come up?
I think they're typical and they're cliched. He made a mistake. No, he didn't make a mistake. A mistake is making a left turn when you intended to go right. It wasn't, in fact, his second chance. It was about his fourth second chance. The first second chance came when he was allowed back into school. The second chance came when he was allowed back on the football team. His coach, Bob Stoops, has said recently that if he had perpetrated this act in 2017 and not 2014, he probably would not have been allowed back on the team. So that was his second chance. And his third second chance was that he was drafted. So you combine that with the notion that, you know, the question that people ask, well, did you ever do anything heinous when you were 18 years old? Well, sure. Don't we all? It didn't involve rearranging someone else's face, you know? So that was the brunt of it. I didn't think that she or that Joe Mixon should be a Bengal, and people misrepresented this, misinterpreted it. I didn't say he did not deserve a second or whatever chance it is. I didn't say that he didn't deserve that. I said that he shouldn't have gotten it here for reasons that I thought were pretty obvious, but he did. So, I mean, that's life. But, yeah, I got all kinds of reaction, not entirely positive to my cause, and most of it was concerned the points that I've already made about second chances. Did you make a mistake? And you know, were you ever 18 and that kind of thing?
And you're saying he shouldn't get a second chance here. Why? Because the Bengals just don't have a good track record at redeeming players? Is that what you're saying?
That's part of it. I think if you look over the years at the players that they have taken with the goal of redemption in mind, I don't know how many of them actually been redeemed. And that goes for, you know, the last 20 or 25 years, not just recently. And the fact that, as I said earlier, this is a town and a fan base that has, you know, suffered over the years from ridicule and embarrassment because the Bengals have brought in players whose outside of football lives were not the best. And I'm not sure this guy, he may or may not have a great support team here. He'll have a coach and an owner who will forgive him time and time again, as we've seen. I don't know if that's great support or if that's great enabling. They had a couple of guys on this team that were good locker room guys, and they're not here anymore. That would be Andrew Whitworth and Doma Topeko. So I don't know what kind of support, quote-unquote, he's going to get from his teammates or from the people that run the club. So it might not have been in his best interest to come to work at this particular NFL outpost.
Now, David, I want to WCPO.com's editorial board took a stance on this, too, and I want to get your reaction to this.
Sure, yeah. Well, we called on people to, instead of going to buy a ticket to a Bengals game this year, if you're upset about the draft of Joe Mixon, to take that money, whatever you might spend on a game, and donate it to a domestic violence organization. So take some action.
So instead of spending $50 on a ticket, donate the $50.
Yeah, exactly. Do something positive with the money. And you know, that's really the only way I think that the Bengals organization are going to get the message if it hurts their pocketbook, because the message has been out there over and over again, as Paul was saying, that what they have done with players who have, you know, checkered backgrounds is just become a joke. And it's time, you know, to take some action and let them know how people think about it.
Yeah, Paul, what are your thoughts on that?
I once boycotted a game myself by raking leaves in a woman's yard in Hyde Park rather than actually go to work.
That up for a long stretch, too, during that season, if I remember right.
I found all kinds of creative ways not to write about the Bengals. But, you know, they, for whatever reason, either they don't understand how the majority of people around here feel about this stuff, or they don't care. And I think they understand it because they're not stupid people. So that would lead me to believe that maybe they just don't give a damn. Because as I said before, trying to redeem a human being obviously is a noble goal. And I will give Mike Brown some credit here in believing that. I think he really feels that way. I think he really does want to try to help these guys. But it hasn't worked. You know, it simply hasn't worked. And then what has worked is the notion of Cincinnati as a city that with a football team that supports silly behavior. Now, whether that's accurate or fair, I don't know. I tend to think some of it is and some of it isn't. But the bottom line is perception is reality in lots of occasions. And you're an organization that's been given a free home, in essence, thanks to the taxpayers, and you're totally ignoring the feelings of the taxpayers.
Yeah, I think, I think the message is that the Bengals are essentially condoning this sort of behavior, even though they say they don't. What they're doing is essentially condoning it by offering this player, even with the discount that you mentioned, it will still be a lucrative contract. And, you know, in this day and age with the issues that the NFL has with violence, domestic violence, that's just absolutely the wrong message to send.
Yeah, and Paul,
well, of course they're condoning it. If they weren't condoning it, they wouldn't be a part of it. It's kind of like fans who've written me angry and who are supporting Nixon, who's saying, you know, who start off their emails or whatever by saying what he did was completely inexcusable, and then proceed to give me 10 excuses for why he should be here. So either you like it or you don't. Either you support it or you don't. If you're going to support it, then be prepared for the backlash.
Well, Paul, what about one of the other defenses that she pushed him first and used a racial slur? I mean, what you've probably heard that quite a bit.
Yeah. One, she didn't use a racial slur. It was a friend of hers, and even Joe Mixon said that. Two, I don't know about you, but I was raised not to strike women. I mean, not to strike anybody. But not to strike women. And
that was a message my parents drove home with me. Yeah.
Yeah, and I got I did get a lot of feedback along those lines. Well, if you want equality, if you're going to hit a guy, expect to get hit back. Like I said, I don't know about you, but I wasn't raised that way. And she lashed out. But who knows exactly what precipitated the whole thing? It depends on what you believe. All I know is what I saw in the video. What I saw in the video was a young woman in a restaurant with a male friend. And then I see Mr. Mixon come in. I don't think she invited him in. I don't think she said, come on and follow me into this place. And they get into it again. So, of course, what she did was wrong. It obviously, to me anyway, didn't warrant his response.
Yeah, his reaction was totally disproportionate to what she did. I mean, he was under really no threat to his personal safety, I don't think.
And a quick question for you, David, from a listener. They wanted to know if WCPO would take this stand if they broadcast NFL games.
Absolutely, we would. That has nothing to do with it. We never took that into account. It's really all about, us urging people to take some action and show the Bengals what they think about this whole affair.
Paul and David, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You bet.
Thank you.
Parents, counselors, and educators are voicing concern about the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why. The TV show depicts a teenager who kills himself. Next Thursday on Cincinnati Edition, we'll be talking with local experts about the series. And if you're a teenager who'd like to share your thoughts, send your recorded message to talk@wvxu.org. For anyone under 18, please include parental permission to use your first name and comments on the air. Thank you for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our programs at wvxu.org.